Okay, we are just past 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead now and mute all. And as usual, everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. And if you do so, please remute yourself after your comment or question. And I will unceremoniously remute anybody who's causing background noise. So welcome to everybody, all the members and guests. And as always, we welcome guests at any time, the Ottawa PCS group meetings. If you want to join, you can come to our website and click on the Join or Renew button at the top of the page, and it'll lead you through the process, but feel free to continue to join as a guest. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck in PDF format, in the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website for your enjoyment. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, Chris, thank you very much. So tonight we've got a bunch of questions that basically finish up our one-question survey from a while ago. And if you recall, the question was, what one thing would you like to know more about relating to computers? And one of the questions that was asked was, well, virtual machines. This individual would like to know about VMs. It turns out we did talk about those quite a while ago. Looks like we gave a presentation on VirtualBox back in 2021 there. So that's something to look up. It looks like it's pretty general, running Linux on Windows and running Windows on Linux. So if either of those are what you need to do, then it probably tells you how. And so I suggest you look that up. And if anybody's got a more recent VM that they've been using and would like to kind of bring us up to date, I guess, then please let us know, and we'll be happy to have that presentation at a future Q&A. Okay, the next question was relating to Bluetooth, and I think, Chris, you have the gear for that.
Yeah, these were my thoughts off the top of my head more than anything else. You know, the overall idea, if you need it, you got to leave it on. I mean, there's no two ways about it if you need it. But if you don't need it, you know, make sure you do turn it off. Why have it consuming electricity, and especially if you're on a laptop, it's burning up some of your battery. And any potential security problems or anything like that go away if you turn it off. One of the things that I really caution people is that if you ever see an invite to pair a Bluetooth device and you're not the one who initiated that pairing, don't accept that invite because who knows what that device will be able to do on your computer. If you're considering using Bluetooth, turning it off when it's not actively being used, probably just turn it off. You know, just why have that functionality built in there if you really don't need it? If you don't trust it when it's not actively being used, on the other hand, then you probably shouldn't trust it when it's in use either. So, you know, just turn it off if you don't need it. And if you do need it, leave it on. That's basically what it comes down to, my thoughts. If anybody else has any other thoughts on Bluetooth, by all means, chime in. I don't consider myself to be an expert on the technology.
So well, Tom says, I would agree with you in terms of turning it off to save the battery. It's really that's really good for phones, for example. I noticed that my phone would run down if I have Bluetooth connected to my car, and then I'm not in the car anymore, but I forget to turn Bluetooth off, and it basically drains the battery. So definitely turn it off if you're not using it.
Yeah.
In terms of tracking, stores can track you, and they don't know it's you, but they track this device as to where you go and so on. And it may help them anonymously change some store prices, because those labels are now often set by Wi-Fi, and they may change according to who is in front of them. If you have an Apple phone, for example, the price usually goes up because you're willing to spend money.
Remember when you get to the cash?
It will. Well, I mean, it knows that your device. It doesn't know you. It doesn't know who you are unless it tracks, although it may track you from, like, this device came here on Tuesday, and they shop on Saturdays too, and so on. So they know the device has been there and which aisle it goes down and stuff like that. So they can then adjust prices on the shelf and perhaps do other things, decide where to put products in aisles and so on, and get an idea of who their customers are, even if they don't know their name.
Deciding where a product goes or something like that on the shelf is one thing. I'm surprised that it's legal for them to adjust pricing according to who happens to be walking by the shelf at that point in time. But I'm not a lawyer.
Okay, Bluetooth, turn it off if you're not using it. Sounds good to me. All right, next up we have networking to protect children. How do you set up networks and computers and phones to protect children from inappropriate content? And I think, Chris, you've got the answers for this one, too.
Okay, yeah. I'm getting some lags on my clicks tonight. There we go. Okay, DNS can certainly help you out here, and there's a number of times we've talked about using DNS for security on a computer. And the way the DNS works, just as a bit of a background to it, the computer doesn't know how to get to cbc.ca or nbcnews.com or anything like that. It knows how to get to an IP address. So it uses the domain name system to translate that domain name to an IP address. So the idea behind this is that instead of using your normal DNS server, which will just blindly give you the IP address, what the replacement DNS server can do is it can look up that IP address and say, is this a known malicious site? And if it is, rather than returning the IP address of that, it'll return another IP address, which basically just brings up a screen and says, this is a bad site, you don't want to go there, we're blocking you from getting there. If it's not a malicious site, then it will return the IP address and your computer will go to it. So there are a number of services out there. Canadian Shield, which is run by the Canadian Internet Registration Authority, or CIRA, they have a couple of configurations that are available on that. So you can do ones which are strictly for security-related issues and things like that. But then there's another one which will do security-related issues, blocking, as well as pornography. And so you could use that. Another one is OpenDNS Family Shield, and that allows you to configure it, again, so it can block specific categories of things. I think they have one set up where you can actually do it just security and pornography, and then there's another one where you can actually specify from 50 different categories of things that you actually want blocked. And so by doing that on preferably your router, so that every computer that is connected up to it is subject to that filtering, will certainly help you out.
Okay, thanks, Chris. The next question is not really, it's a number of questions, a kind of compendium of questions, and various people want to know about safe settings for Windows 11, how to ensure anonymity, and just, computer security in general. Now, you know that Chris has got the answer to this, but you know how shy he is. He won't want to tell you what's going on, so I just point out that he's actually going to be giving his Protecting Your PC presentation at the Metcalf branch of the library on May the 7th in the afternoon at 2 o'clock. And you notice here in the blurb it says it takes basically 15 minutes to have your computer compromised if it's not secure. So Chris is going to tell you all the things you can do to prevent your PC from being hacked. And of course he's one of those guys who likes spending money, so all of his solutions are essentially free. But he's got lots of them, so it's worth going and listening to.
And that is my most popular presentation I give at the OPL by far. I have given that 108 times now, and so the next most popular has been given 71 times. So it is a very popular topic, and I highly recommend that anybody who has concerns about security on their computer check it out.
Okay. All right. The next question was about VPNs. And what one thing would you like to know more about VPNs? Well, Chris, I think you've got a lot of things that we've talked about here in the past.
Yeah, let me just paste in some links from this slide and the next. So, yeah, there's we've talked about it numerous times, and so when somebody says a top, you know, they want to know more about VPNs, I would certainly suggest you just check out these presentations that we've given before at Q&A, and these were the ones over the last couple of years, and then I pasted all of these into the chat as well. And then on this slide here, we have other ones, and I pasted in the URLs for these as well. So there's a lot of information we have on VPNs. I really caution people to not think that VPN is doing more than it is actually designed to do. I think it is really of limited use for most people. It is really good for getting around geo-blocking and not much else. People who think of it as being a security-related issue is very limited in what it will actually provide you when it comes to actual security. So take a look at those. And if anybody wants to, after going through all of those ones and seeing what we've talked about in the past, if there's something more specific that you're interested in about VPNs, by all means, chime in with an email to suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we'll see if we can fill in any gaps in that. And if anybody wants to argue with me about the idea of a VPN being giving you high security, by all means, speak up. I'd be happy to have that discussion.
Tom's just noting that some browsers offer a free VPN that's built in, like Opera and Firefox.
Yeah. Now, so that is a VPN that is specific to that browser only. A true VPN protects everything. Well, protects. It affects everything that is on your computer, regardless of whether it's a browser or your email client software or whatever. But if you just need it for in the browser, which is often the case when you just want it for things like geo-blocking, getting around that, often it's in the browser, and that may be a good solution for you.
Also, you can create your own VPN by, like if you're away from your home and so on, that you basically connect back through your home network for all your data. So it is possible to create, to roll your own VPN. You do need a computer on all the time, of course, at home that has the VPN running on it.
Okay, Chris, next up is yours too.
Okay, I will forward us on that. So just in terms of we've gone through a number of these questions that were posed to the answers to the survey, and a lot of them are things that we have covered in the past at Q&A. And so what I suggest is if anybody is looking for specific answers to anything, why not take a look at, you know, to see if we've actually covered it before. And we've had 260 Q&A sessions since COVID-19 lockdown happened and over the last 6 years. And we've covered 1,937 topics in there. So there may be a reasonable chance that the answer you're looking for will have already been covered, at least in a general sense, and maybe even very specific. So if you get through all of that, you know, then you're still not answered, then by all means, you know, come back and we can try and home in on it. So the easiest way to get started is to browse and search the Q&A index, which is just a document without any links in it. It's just all of the topics and the date that they were given. And then if you find something in there that is actually of interest to you, then you can go to the archives. And the archives actually has the links to the PDF files and the audio tracks so that you can go and find the actual information that was presented. So everybody's encouraged to take advantage of that. Alan maintains this on a weekly basis, and so I know a number of our members have used the information in there in the past and found nuggets that they found very valuable. So check it out, but don't think of it as being that we're trying to prevent people from asking questions. Certainly if things are not covered or not covered to the level that you wanted, we're more than happy to expand on things.
Yeah, and just a note on the index, it's not that comprehensive. It's basically just a list of the topic titles from the various agendas for the meetings. So if you put in something like VPN, you'll probably find it, but don't put in a whole paragraph and expect to have a very detailed search. And I just noticed the laboriously bit, and it's not terribly laborious. I actually have a Python script that edits the PDF, that edits the ODT file, the document file, and then automatically creates the PDF, and that's based on the weekly agenda that we use. So it's pretty well automatic.
Alan, you're supposed to tell everybody that you slave over a hot stove on this one.
Well, yeah, I must have spent at least 10 minutes on the script. That's right. Okay, the last question I think we had. Yes, it is. The last question that was in the survey, somebody wants to know, how do you change the ownership for Google Docs, and what's the best type of ownership if you're working with a group rather than documents for your own use? Now, neither Chris nor I don't use Google Docs, and I don't think Chris uses it very much. And I don't think we know the answer to this. So if anybody knows the answer, this is one that we're going to throw open to the crowd. And if anybody knows the answer, let us know, and we'll talk about it later on tonight, or we'll do a follow-up. Anyway, in the meantime, Chris is up again with another keyboard shortcut.
There we go. Keyboard shortcut number 10. So again, this is to speed things along rather than taking your hands off the keyboard, moving the mouse around, clicking on things. If you can just use a keyboard shortcut, it's usually quicker and more accurate. So tonight says to move between tabs in Excel. So here I have an example of an Excel workbook with a number of worksheets within it, and the current tab is Analysis. If you actually want to get to the previous tab, you just press Control Page Up, and if you want to get to the next tab, you do Control and Page Down. So it's a quick way to move around between your sheets without taking your hands off the keyboard. There used to be a keystroke that you could use to go to the first tab and the last tab, and Microsoft, in their infinite wisdom, took away that capability.
Yeah, you've got to keep changing that user interface, keep people on their toes.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We'll look forward to number 11. Okay, next up we have a segment of our new 2x2 series. If you remember, this is where we basically take two applications that basically do the same thing and kind of compare and contrast the features of the two programs. And this time we're going to talk about audio players. And actually, we're always asking people to help out by making presentations. And Steve Parker has got a presentation here on these two audio players. So, is Steve, are you going to present? Are you going to share your screen, Steve?
Sure. Yeah.
Is that your wallpaper?
I haven't shared it yet, so here we go.
Here it comes.
Yeah, okay, so do you see that?
And just give it a sec. Yep, yeah. I got it.
Okay.
You're not in slideshow mode, though. What we're seeing is...
No, that's right, yeah. I found that if I put it into slideshow mode, all the other stuff that's supposed to be always on top isn't. So okay. It's easier to... do it this way, because I wanted to show that was can you see the rocket ship?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, good. So what I did was I've got my version of Winamp. There's what my main control thing looks like, and from that I can there's the menu there, which has got quite a lot of stuff to it. The options and preferences, there's a whole slew of things. After I'd been playing with it for a while with the FLAC files, I realized that it wasn't playing it in 24-bit. So I went through all these, and these are plugins for Winamp in order to get it to work. Some were with Bluetooth and others weren't. And from what I've seen, if you want an audio file quality, forget about Bluetooth. It's not worth the hassle. So anyway, there's a whole slew of panels that you can add to Winamp. This is the list of all the tracks that I've got in this playlist, just some of the best ones that I added together. And then it's also got another pane that I added in, this ELO song, Don't Bring Me Down, actually has the lyrics to it. And we heard this song in the bowling alley, and everybody had thought it was, there's one line in it. Where the heck is it now? Yeah, here, where he says, don't bring me down, Bruce. And, of course, everybody thinks it's Bruce. I thought it was Bruce. But so I brought it up on this, on Winamp, and sure enough, yeah, there it is there. So he actually does. Apparently, it was a made-up word that he just threw in there as a sort of placeholder and never got back to it to actually fill it in with a... So it, when you hear it, it does actually sound like he's singing Bruce. I mean, he says, before I get off the floor, being knocked on the floor by Bruce Lee. Yeah, well, that makes sense. another panel that I've got is the screen cover for it. So I can turn those on, bring them up, down, whatever. That's one of the functions that I wanted to try and get with Music Bee. The reason I realized that Winamp didn't quite have what it takes anymore is that it wouldn't play 5.1 audio very well at all. And it was missing a lot of the sound quality that it should have. When I played a surround sound version of Paperback Writer, the Beatles track that they remastered in 2015, I think it was. They did it in 24-bit in 5.1 surround sound, and I've got that track on my Google Drive. I don't know if, Chris, can you post that one in the chat? Did you get that?
No, I didn't. You sent it to me?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay, I will.
It's got the Paperback Writer link. It's about 130 megabytes or so.
I haven't seen your email.
No, it's not an email. It's in the chat.
Oh, in the chat. Oh, okay. Yes. Well, everybody has it in the chat then. Sure.
No, they wouldn't do because I sent it just to you.
Oh, just to me. Okay, sorry.
I didn't know whether you wanted it to show up.
I am totally out of here. Okay.
I didn't know whether you wanted it to show up in the chat or not.
No, that's fine. I'll copy it over to the public chat. Okay. That's great. Thanks.
Okay. So it's also got the download for Music Bee, and it's got the YouTube guide, which is pretty extensive. I've been through the first one, and it's taken me like a week to do. So the Winamp is pretty simple. Well, there's a lot of customization you can do to it. I didn't bother making this thing any fancier than what it came with. There was more than enough in the menus and all the other stuff. So anyway, the comparison that they got is between what was on the Winamp and what's in the sort of next generation audio player, which is Music Bee. And the Winamp takes the approach where it's a, sort of like a gadget, because it got here with all the stuff attached to it, and I can turn that off, or I can minimize it, and I can move it wherever I want. The way that Music Bee looks at it is they sort of treat it like a Windows File Explorer, complete with tabs across the top, as you can see there. It's not, it's a bit more unwieldy than Winamp, but as I discovered, boy, does it do a heck of a lot more. Wow, it makes Winamp look pretty simplistic by comparison. When you, if anybody downloads that paperback writer and plays it with their music player, whichever one you want, DLC does a so-so job, just slightly better than Winamp, but certainly nowhere near as good as Music Bee. When I first played it on Winamp and realized, yeah, this kind of sucks. It's not a whole, in fact, it's actually worse than what I had before. So I played it with Music Bee, and it was like, wow, you got to be kidding me. And this was playing it with the same hardware, the same file, and everything else. The only difference was the players. So they've really upped the bar with this Music Bee. Let's see. I'll start the So these are the other components that it's got as well. There's an equalizer and the playlist. You can move. These aren't really songs that it's shown on here, but that's AI for you. These will all be your songs, whatever you want, and you can put them in and move them around in any order you want. I usually list them alphabetically because it's easier to find them that way. The way Winamp works is that it is got a set dimensions, like it says over here, with the rigid pixel dimensions. So what that means is that all the components snap together so that you can move them around and join them up and like building blocks. The other thing that they did with Winamp is sort of a transition. Come on, next one. There's the original one, the one I showed you. That's one I'm still using. Then they went to this modern skin, and there's a whole bunch of weird-looking ones like this. It's fine if you like that thing, but I tend to go more for as small as I can get it with as much stuff in it as I can. The form of that follows the function. For me, that just looks kind of blobby. The next thing they did was they took this with the extra playlists and the rest of it that I showed you, and stuck them all together. You end up with something close to what Music Bee looks like that way. And this is the Music Bee, which is more like a workstation, whereas Winamp is more like a just a gadget that you can play music with. The advantage of Music Bee is that not only can it play pretty much any audio considerably better than Winamp, you can change these headings to virtually anything you want. And it's quite astounding, all the the columns and stuff you can put in here. It's kind of rigid as far as the display goes, but there's a lot of customization you can do to it. I'm hoping I can change all that stuff to make it look like it, the way I want it to, rather than the way it comes straight out of the box kind of thing. So there's the problem they got with Music Bee is trying to make it as manageable as Winamp is with all the extra stuff that's in Music Bee. And they've got a mini player, this one, which is just the bar and where you are on the timeline. Then they've got that at the bottom. Then they've got all the other album covers and all the other track listings and all that sort of stuff. And then they've got the compact player, which is kind of like the Winamp, only it's missing a lot of stuff. Then they've got the theater mode, which, so they're trying a whole bunch of different things out. Whether any of them will be better than Winamp, I kind of doubt it. This was one that I picked up on, which was exactly the same sort of thing I was looking for. Somebody had put in to help me make Music Bee look like Winamp, which is what I wanted to do as well. So I can dock it to multiple monitors. But this was obviously done in AI, because there ain't no way you're going to get 1080p across here and then 1920. So obviously that should have been 1080 on this side and 1920 across there, but anyway. Okay, next one. So there's the original Winamp. There's the problem they were having with the size of the layouts and pixel sizes. Trying to make it smaller means they end up cutting a lot of stuff out. When they add the stuff in, it doesn't fit the restraints for the size. That was another, I've never actually seen that one. In fact, this one's got a bunch of gibberish on here, which is obviously AI slop. It's got another control here. Now, is that a play or is that a stop? Yeah, this sort of comparison shows them fairly well. That was the good thing about Winamp, was that you can move the individual data blocks around as you want. With Music Bee, they were kind of all window-fied, or whatever the term for that is, in the player. The minimization and arrangement of the things, I still think, is better in Winamp than it is in Music Bee. As I said in here, in order to make it fit into the thing, they end up losing a lot of stuff. Winamp also had a visualization feature in it that was really kind of cool. It would generate images based on the music. So it would actually move around with the beat and the voices and everything else. And the sound would actually generate the visuals. And that's what this image is supposed to be showing. There is nothing like that I've seen so far in Music Bee, but it does have this theater mode, which shows, the cover and the description and all the other details of the songs and the albums and everything else.
Steve?
Yeah.
You were a big fan of FUBAR 2000. Is this way better than that?
It's a completely different animal altogether. FUBAR 2000 is more like an editor. It doesn't really have that much functionality in terms of managing your library beyond editing the individual files. When you want something like on Winamp, I've got about 4,000 files all in the playlist on there. And with MusicBee, I was actually able to put almost, well, not quite the entire thing, because that would be like 6 terabytes, but a pretty good portion of them, more than I could put into Winamp anyway. MusicBee has a really interesting function that allows you to create playlists based on what you specify. You can use and or and if this and if that and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to create a playlist that had all my surround sound 5.1 tracks in it. I should live long enough for it to do all that. It took it way too long to do it, and then there didn't seem to be any way to actually save it, because it would have been pretty huge. So even MusicBee has its limits, but it certainly does things well beyond what Winamp can do, or what FUBAR 2000 can do. But the FUBAR can actually do a lot of things that so far I haven't seen MusicBee be able to do yet. It's probably the closest thing to MusicBee in terms of the quality of the sound that it produces. As far as the three of them, comparing Winamp, FUBAR, and MusicBee, the MusicBee wins hands down. It's no contest. Well, if you get a copy of that paperback writer track of the Beatles, and you play that one, you'll be able to hear what I'm talking about. There wasn't much point in me playing it so you could hear it, because it's on my system. You wouldn't be able to hear any difference, really, because you'd still be hearing it through your system. So you need to download the file, get a copy of MusicBee, and play it through there, and you'll definitely notice a difference with it being a lot better than any other player.
Okay, Steve, you need to wrap up your 2x2 segment.
Yep, that's pretty much it. That's the end of the slides.
Thought there was one more.
Well, there is, yeah, but it doesn't really cover anything. It's sort of a transition showing between one and the other. And it's going from minimalist to power user.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that.
Stop share. I guess I should have turned the slides off, too, shouldn't I?
Okay, have I got the... That's right. So we're back to my slideshow?
Yep.
Okay.
So this came into suggestion box. So person was trying to figure out more about two-factor authentication apps. And so they come across a New York Times article and compared or tested 13 of them and came up with a recommendation on two of them. So they were wondering if anybody is familiar with them and what they think, or for that matter, do you use a different authentication app that you think is the bee's knees? So just going through what the New York Times article had, they compared Twilio, or one of the recommendations was Twilio Authy, and they said it's easy to use, cross-platform and so forth. One thing they didn't like was that you have to create an account with a phone number and email address in order to actually use it, and they thought that that was unnecessary, and some people may object to that. They did like that it had end-to-end encryption for the backup and syncing codes between devices. And then they also looked at or recommended Google Authenticator, and one of the things about it was that it was really simple, reliable, very straightforward, and if you use it with a Google account, it'll seamlessly back up your data between devices and keep it backed up to the cloud, which is kind of nice. And you could export your account information securely using a QR code. It doesn't use end-to-end encryption, which was one of the things that I thought was not great about it. So they said that the choice really depends on what features are important to you. And they said if you're really put off by the whole idea of two-factor authentication apps on your devices, probably the Google Authenticator is just the simplest one to use. If you're concerned about law enforcement breaking into things and getting access to your two-factor authentication backups and so forth, they say something like the Authy app that encrypts your backups with a key that you create will keep it secret. And if you're on an app with secure backups, it doesn't require you to create an account, and you can live with some interface quirks, whatever those are. There's another app they had which was called Duo. So they came up with a final tally on the whole thing, saying that two-factor authentication is not without its drawbacks. Bad guys can still trick you into accepting a code and things like that, or giving up a code in order to log on to a malicious site. They made a point of never send your two-factor authentication code to someone else. And they talked a little bit, I guess, about passkeys, and that's a newer technology that is going to replace all our passwords and our two-factor authentication apps and so forth. It's phishing resistant, secure credentials. It's still really, really new. You still need two-factor authentication apps for sites that don't yet support passkeys, but eventually everybody is sort of hoping that passkeys is going to take over and do everything that is actually needed. And so I guess the final thing is, what do you use, folks? So any thoughts on those two apps that were mentioned by the New York Times? If you have any experience with those and think they're great or bad, whatever, by all means chime in. Or if you use another authenticator app, what is it you like about it? What don't you like about it? Now, my thoughts on this is really that all authenticator apps should work with any service, basically. So, to me, I've never really thought about the idea of one being, I should use this instead of the other one. They all just sort of work. And so rather than having, half a dozen authenticator apps, you should be able to get away with just having one authenticator app on any device. So unless you see that something truly distinguishes one from another. So I guess with that was the wrap-up of that question that came in. With my commentary on it, and if anybody else has an idea on authenticator apps, please feel free to chime in.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yep. Just want to share something that happened to me recently. I have WinScribe on my NVIDIA Shield for my TV, and there was some updates from NVIDIA Shield, and then I had to reset my WinScribe VPN. And I was waiting and waiting and waiting for my email, for the email with the number, and it never came. So I wrote to the company, and I realized after I wrote to them that my authenticator was linked to my Microsoft authenticator. So do not forget which method you use for any of those. That's the moral of the story.
Good point. I actually have two authenticators on my phone, and I don't know why. I think it was before I understood anything about authenticators. I thought you actually had to have a separate authenticator for each service or something. And so I'm in that same boat where I have different authenticators for different accounts. And that one's got something.
While everybody's typing into the chat what they use, I'll tell you that I use an authenticator tool from the Sophos Intercept X antivirus app on my phone. basically, if you look in the first image there, there's a hamburger menu. If you hit that, then it gives you a whole bunch of things, like a QR code scanner. But it also gives you access to an authenticator. And then what you do there is you set up the phone to access various accounts. So in this case, I'm showing that if I want to log on to the admin panel for the club's website, then I have to use a user ID or password, and I have to give it a six-digit code, which is generated by this authenticator. So what happens is, as soon as you open the page, I can't show you a photograph of the page because it won't let me take a screenshot. Kind of neat. So you can't steal all my accounts because I can't show them to you. Anyway, basically, it shows one account here for WordFence, and it has this little annular circle thing here, and it's basically counting down from 1 minute, and when the blue matches up and the whole thing goes blue, then the number changes. So you have basically a minute to enter the number to do the two-factor authentication. And I noticed somebody here said that, I think it's Tom says he used Google Authenticator, but he ended up with duplicates that he can't delete. And Harvey uses Microsoft Authenticator. Allison uses that too. They use that at work. So I've never had any problems with it. They work really well. Anyway, if anybody has any other comments, put them in the chat and we'll revisit it later on. So the final thing I have tonight is another part in my Vibe Coding series, and I just want to remind you that we're planning to have a Vibe Coding competition in October. That assumes that we're going to get some entries to the competition before October, so we know it's going to go ahead. And basically, there's going to be two streams, if you like. One prize is going to be offered for the most useful application that's been developed, and the second prize is for the best presentation of how you actually did that development. So it can be good, bad, or indifferent. If it worked, great. If it didn't work, but it was interesting or frustrating, as long as there's a story there, we'd like to hear it. You don't remember Vibe Coding, then it's basically automatic coding. You get an AI chatbot to do the coding for you. So you don't need to know the programming. You don't need to know anything about scripting, no languages. You just tell AI, I want you to do this and generate the code for me. And then when it doesn't do exactly what you want, then you say, no, don't do that. Do something else. And you keep going round and round until the code basically does what you want in terms of the application. Now, it can be a long process. It depends how big your project is. I've already done several examples of Python scripts and I forget what else I did, but they've been fairly short projects. But if you have something a bit more complicated, then you've got a number of months even now until the fall. So I thought I would try a more complicated one just to see what happens. And this is PC Magazine's WMatch utility. It basically compares two disks or two folders and looks at the files and folders within them. And then you can select individual files or all the files that are different. You can copy them, you can delete them, you can move them, you can do all kinds of things. It's actually really quite useful. However, there's a problem. If I use a 16 gig flash drive, it works really well. But if I try a 64 gig flash drive, then it doesn't show the files and folders in the window. The windows are blank. So I can't transfer any files because I can't see them. And it turns out that the 16 gig drive is FAT32 and the 64 gig drive is NTFS. And the problem is that WMatch is a 32-bit program from the DOS and really old Windows days, and it just can't handle NTFS file permissions and attributes. And so when it comes to listing the files, it just gives up. So I said, well, let's go and ask, and I decided this time I'm going to use ChatGPT. And rather than tell it exactly what I wanted, I asked it the question, are you aware of the PC Magazine utility WMAX32? And it said, oh, yes, I'm familiar with that. It's a file directory comparison and synchronization utility, and it does yada, 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 all these wonderful things. So I said, well, in that case, I'd like to create a modern version of this program using vibe coding. So what language, what programming language would you suggest that I use? And it says, oh, well, you know, you might need cross-platform support, and you might want faster file system access, or you might want to easily build a graphical user interface. And it says, probably you want to use Python, and it's using Qt PySide Thick, which is a library that does GUIs, basically. If you want high performance, then you could try Rust. And if you want better styling, then you might use C#. I don't know Rust or C#, but it actually says later on that I recommend that you use Python with PySide 6, and it will do wonderful things. And in particular, it gives you cross-platform support, which is interesting. So, you know, it says a modern version should have multi-threading and be able to handle large directories and that kind of stuff. And it says, if you want, I can show you a simple prototype, 150 lines of code. Here you are, it's going to give me two folder panes. It's going to scan the folders on the left and right hand side. It's going to compare them by name, size, and date. And then it will tell me which are only on the left or only on the right and that kind of stuff. So it says you have to install using pip install PySide 6. That's the library you want. And then you're going to save this code as wmaxprototype.py, which is a Python script. And then to run it, you need to say Python and then give it the name of the script. And so if you remember, we're not going to read the code. We're just going to copy the code using this little icon over here, copy it to the clipboard, and then save it to this Python script file. One of the interesting things about ChatGPT, you notice after you've given it a number of prompts, it says, oh, you've only got two messages remaining. Perhaps you'd like to upgrade, i.e. pay for a business trial. Or what you do is you come back the next day and start over or carry on from where you left off. So, interestingly, it says, I asked it because it said in the previous slide, I think, right here, it said this was a bash command. So I'm thinking, oh, maybe it's giving me a generation for Linux. So I said, is a program for Windows or Linux as the operating system? But it says it's going to use both. So that's fine. And it says another interesting thing, develop on Linux Mint if you want, or you can develop on Python, on Windows. And in particular, if you use this application called Pi Installer, it will create a Windows .exe file. I've never tried that, so later on in the series, we're going to see how that works. So here we go. We're going to take the advice, and we're going to use pip install PySide 3. I've already got Python installed on my Windows box. So I install the library, and then I've already saved the script to this Python file. So I go to the folder where I've got my software, and I give it the command to run Python with the script, and here's the result in all of its glory. I wasn't quite sure what was going on here, but of course what I need to do is tell it which is the left folder and which is the right folder. And if I do that, then I give it my D drive, which is my data partition, and I give it the U drive, which is my backup flash drive, and it's giving me a whole bunch of stuff. However, it only gives me the left folder. It's not showing me the right folder. So I have to give it some more prompts. But later on it tells me, if you want, I can show you how to build a true two-pane interface just like the original. Well, wouldn't that be nice? So let's tell it to do that. Okay, modify the script to display a true panel interface just like the last one. And so here's the code. It's generated some more code. We'll copy that. Copy it into the file and run it. And now you can see that we've actually got I've got one folder here, and I'm comparing it over here to my flash drive. One of the things it does that I really don't like is it tells me what the status is for every file in this column in the left window, and for every file in the right window. And WMAX doesn't do that. And the other thing, it expands all the folders. So instead of just seeing a list of folders and then some files, I've got an oddball file here. This is a free file sync database file. But then I've got a zero archives, which is a folder, and then some files inside that, and then another one, some files, and then something else. And it's giving me kind of a enhanced list before it's actually giving me the basics. And so here, if you remember, this is the way that WMAX does it. It shows you the folders and then individual files in the root. And instead of telling you, it gives you a status column in the center. So it doesn't touch the folders. It just looks at the files. It tells you that this file is different and these files are all the same on both sides. So you don't need to do anything with those. So we're not quite there yet. But that is a fairly complicated program, I think. I didn't really want to tell it everything that it had to do for me. I think it was easier to tell it to kind of clone WMAX. But it's a good example of where things don't actually work the way you want them to first time. So you have to give it more prompts to make it work the way that you want it to work. And that's going to take some time. So if you've got a project that's a bit more complicated than a really simple thing, then you should be glad that we're not going to review these things until October. So if you have a project in mind and you want to make an entry in the competition, at some point tell us what you want to do, and we'll know that we have a competition in progress. Anyway, I'll come back to this later on sometime, and we'll see how I'm doing with my WMAX clone.
So, Alan, once you've created your program, make sure you don't call it tree size.
No, it's called WMAX clone, I think.
Yeah.
No, it's not as sophisticated as tree size. Tree size does all kinds of wonderful things, like comparing it by size and that kind of stuff. Okay. Any other questions?
Don't see anything in the chat.
Okay. All right. Well, we've got a couple of minutes before this 8:30. If anybody has anything else, we can do that. But let's go on and do the wrap up. Library presentations are coming up tomorrow night at the Rosemount branch, 6 p.m. Linda is going to be talking about organizing and showing your photos. Cumberland on Saturday, 2 p.m. in the afternoon. Chris has got ins and out of electronic mail again. And then on Monday, May the 4th, in the evening at 6 p.m., Linda's got one of her armchair travel series to Iceland at the Saint Laurent branch. And I remind you that if you want to register for these, you have to go to the link there and log on to the library's website and register for any of the presentations that Linda and Chris are giving in the future. Harvey Hope is looking after our pizza queue, our pizza party this year. He'd very much like to hear who's coming and how much, what kind of food you want, and if you're bringing people with you and stuff like that. So take a look at the website. That gives you all the details. But if you're going to come to the pizza party, then register by email to that email address. And before that, that's the June meeting, June the 10th. Before that, May the 13th meeting is going to be Ask the Geek. So we've got a whole bunch of geeks lined up in a panel ready to answer your questions. So think hard what questions you would like to ask them. They know everything about everything to do with computers, so I'm sure you won't be able to ask a question that they can't answer.
Especially the fourth one from the left.
That must be Harvey. Yeah, that's Harvey. fourth one from the right. Okay. So if you want to send your questions in ahead of time, you can send them to my email address so Chris doesn't get to peek at them, and I won't give them to anybody else. I will create a list and see how we do. I see Richard Bradford's got his hand up from Melbourne.
Yeah. Well, just posted in the chat about Atlas OS, which originally Tim Keekes posted a video about this Atlas OS, which was supposedly a cut down Windows 11 with all the telemetry and advertising stripped out of it. So it looks like an interesting option if people want to stay with the Windows 11 environment rather than switching over to Linux.
Okay, great. So you've got a link in the chat there for that?
Yep. It's about a third of the way up from the bottom of the chat.
Okay, so if you want to check that out, the link is in the chat and it will be on the website sometime. Zoom is sometimes getting really slow at processing the files, so I'll try and get to them tonight, but if it takes a long time, it may not be available until tomorrow. Okay, so final thing, hope everybody enjoyed tonight, but next week we have another Q&A, May the 6th. So if you have questions or you've got follow-ups on the things we've talked about tonight, if you've got topics that you'd like to share, like another 2x2 segment, for example, like Steve did tonight, thanks Steve for that. Any of the above, just send us a note to suggestion box at opcug.ca and we'll add your topic to the agenda. So I hope you enjoyed our presentations tonight, and we'll see you next week.
And just as we're finalizing up, there was something from Mavo who's using savefrom.net to download videos, but they recently made it unusable for Canadians. And no, don't have VPN, don't know how to use them. Are there other sites that people recommend? And so this is for downloading videos. If anybody has anything, throw it into the chat. And we can help out Mavo.
I'll send the information into the suggestion box and we'll do a follow-up next week.
Yes, that'd be a good idea, Mavo, if you could send that in. We will add that to next week, seeing as we're right at the end here. So thanks for me as well, folks. Thanks for showing up and participating. And we will see you next week.